On the phone with me right now is Kay Krebs, an original member of the Pixies 3. Hi, Kay.
Hello, how are you, Brian?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
I grew up in a small town in south central Pennsylvania, only 5 miles from the Maryland border, called Hanover, Pennsylvania. And so did all the Pixies 3, by the way.
So you're all from Hanover, so that's close to Baltimore and not too far from Philadelphia.
Right. We're about 70 miles from Baltimore and a little farther than that, about 150 miles from Philadelphia.
So what was it that got you into your interest in singing?
Well, actually, we started as a duo, Debbie and I. We were neighbors. We lived on the same block. I was 2 years older than she. And we used to perform everything from little plays to singing to dancing, anything, in her breezeway. And we had a curtain that we would put up and we would charge $0.02. One of the acts that we did was we imitated the Everly Brothers, and this was in 1957. In fact, I have a picture of this I should show you. So we got such rave reviews from our neighborhood audience that we entered a local talent show and won first prize, $15, and that kind of started us. Right after that, not more than a couple of months, the song Lollipop came out. And I think that was the Quartets, but I'm not sure. And we decided we needed a third person. So we looked over the street, but there wasn't anybody for a couple of blocks away. But we did find a third person who was a good singer, and her name was Midge. And she joined the group, and, we sort of went on from there.
So it was you, Midge, and Debbie as the Pixies, or how did the name come about?
Well, actually, we started out, the duo was called the Katie Dids. That was for Kay and Debbie, and then we became the Katie Mids when Midge joined. And then nobody really liked that name, but there was also a popular haircut called the Pixies out at that time, and a couple of us got our haircut like that, and then we named ourselves the Pixies. And we wore the Pixies, actually, for quite a few years until Mercury signed us. And they did some research and found that there was another girl group in Baltimore named the Pixies that had had one record, but it didn't chart. And they thought it was just better to change our name, and they suggested the Pixies 3.
So did you ever enter any talent contests, in other words, something beyond the breezeway?
Oh, yes. Actually, we became sort of professional talent contest hunters. And everywhere we could find one, and we won quite a few. And that sort of led to performances at service clubs like the Rotary and the Elks, and that led to carnivals and small fairs. And actually, we were working probably 3 nights a week by 1960-61. We also spent summers on the Steel Pier in Atlantic City in the Tony Grant Stars of Tomorrow show. That was actually one of our favorite events of that period. From that, we were seen by someone from the Ted Mack show. We were on Ted Mack twice. We won once, and we lost the second time. And I believe that was in 1961.
There had to have been then a point where you did a show that somebody from Mercury spotted you.
Yeah, well, actually, what happened was we had met this boy band. Actually, it was two Everly Brother wannabes, two guys, at the Steel Pier. And two of us had fallen in love with these two. And they lived in New Jersey, right outside of Philadelphia. They were telling us that at this nightclub in Philadelphia on Thursday nights, there was an open mic night, and that, quote, famous record producers, end quote, often came there. So we went down to their house. We stayed with their parents, and they took us to the Venus Lounge, it was called. And actually, we were all underage. We were 14 and 16 at the time. So we weren't allowed to be in that area except to perform, you know, in the lounge area where they sold alcohol. So we stayed in the kitchen until it was time to come on, and we went on, and I think we sang Moon River in good three-part harmony, and I played the piano. And John Madera and David White with Mercury happened to be there. And that's kind of how it started, although that we didn't get the contract right away. That took a little maneuvering.
So you had to maneuver your way into the contract then, huh?
Well, what happened was they really liked us, at the Venus Lounge, and they gave us their business card. I think they were with Jamie Guyton at the time, and they had just gotten a deal to produce for Mercury. And they told us to call them, and that they wanted to sign us when they got on Mercury. Well, we called them, and they never returned our calls. And we just couldn't figure this out. Of course, we were, you know, small-town kids, and we just believed anything anybody told us, typically. At the time, then, they had released a record by the Sherrys. I don't know if you remember the Sherrys, but they were a Philadelphia girl group, and they came out with a hit that charted, top 100, I'm not sure how far, called Pop, Pop, Popeye.
Mm-hmm.
And there were three Sherrys, and it was just the kind of thing that we could do. So what we did was we worked up the song, Pop, Pop, Popeye, and we had our mothers drive us to Philadelphia. We had their address on the business card, and we walked into their office, and of course the receptionist didn't want to let us in to see them, and we said, well, we're just going to sit here until they hear us sing one song, then we'll go. And we sat there for quite a few hours, and actually I remember this, that I was just mortified. I was so embarrassed, you know, to be charging in like this without an appointment. But fortunately, we had a kind of aggressive mother in our family that said, "Now we're just going to do this and stop worrying about it." So after several hours of sitting there, they did have us come in, and they had a piano, and we sang our version of Pop, Pop, Popeye, and we thought it was much better than the Sherrys. All they said afterwards was, "You got the words wrong."
Huh.
They wrote that song, by the way.
Uh-huh.
But they did end up signing us, and we had a contract the next week.
Well, it sounds like that visit paid off.
It did.
So you've got the contract now. It's still you, Midge, and Debbie as the Pixies 3.
Right.
Tell us about your first song and your first recording.
The first recording was done in Philadelphia at Recco Art, and it was called Birthday Party. It was just an amazing experience for all of us. We had never sung with an orchestra. Usually I was the orchestra. I played the piano, and the other two played ukuleles, actually. And some of our early demos were done. And we had done a couple of demos before they signed us, by the way.
Mm.
And in fact, we'd done them in Recco Art, where we paid for them ourselves. And our boyfriends that I mentioned earlier played guitar, rhythm and bass guitar, and I played the piano, and we had ukuleles. It's a very interesting sound.
Yeah.
So we were back in the studio, but we were back in the studio with a full band, and it was wonderful. Needless to say, it turned out just great. And I took a tape home, played it for all of my friends, and shortly thereafter, it came out, and we heard it on the radio.
Now, this is summer of 63, is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Summer of 63.
Do you remember the first time that you heard that song on the radio?
I do. I do, as a matter of fact. Actually, I knew it was going to happen, so we all did, so we were listening. There was one station in our area that you had to have, and we had visited the station and played the tape before we even had the actual record for a couple of the disc jockeys there. And they said, well, as soon as we get the record, we'll be sure to play it since you're local girls. We didn't know. They got it, I guess, from the local distributor. We weren't sure when it was coming on, but it was just an unbelievable moment that I don't think today's artists can appreciate, because everybody has a CD player in their car, and it's easy to listen to your music in the radio, but it wasn't back then. I mean, there weren't even transistor radios or anything. You either listened to your music on your 45 record player at home, or you heard music, you know, played over the radio, which was never yours, of course. So it was just like an unbelievable moment.
Birthday Party did really well on the charts, and as I see it, it probably should have gone higher than it did. There were several stations that I know of that it actually got to number one on their regional or local charts.
Oh, yes. You know, it sold a lot of records. The problem was that it peaked in different areas at different times, so it never got past, I believe, 39 in the national charts in any one week. The thing that happened to us happened, I think, to a lot of groups at the time. The major labels like that would release a record from a new artist, and they never put any money behind it, marketing, until they saw it make noise in one of the major markets, and then they would go after some ads and things like that. And that's kind of what happened to us. When it first came out, the only people applying it really were our local stations, and also, I don't know if you've ever heard of Buddy Dean.
Buddy Dean, he had the TV show, didn't he, as well as a radio show?
Yeah, he had a TV show in Baltimore. In fact, he's the subject of the play Hairspray.
Okay.
It was the Buddy Dean show that story was written about, and the guy that wrote the story was one of the dancers on Buddy Dean. But anyway, we had gone to one of his record hops right before, I guess, we had the contract with Mercury to see if he could get us a contract, some kind of a record deal. So we waited till the end of the record hop, and he sat and listened. I played the piano again, same old routine, and we all three sang. And he said, well, girls, I can't get you a record contract, but if you ever do get a record, I'll play it. So, of course, as soon as we got a record, we called Buddy Dean, and we went down to his show, and he probably had us on his show at least three times, and he played our record every day. And it became number one in Baltimore. And actually, that was the market that we needed for Mercury to give us some publicity. But meanwhile, within a couple of days, it was number one in New England and number one in Florida. But it hadn't hit the West Coast. By the time it finally hit the West Coast, it had peaked in the East Coast, and it was kind of the same way. It peaked in certain markets early, like Detroit early, and late in Los Angeles. And in New York, I don't think it was ever played in New York City. It's really kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting just how regional everything could be back then.
Uh-huh.
So on the strength of Birthday Party, then, I imagine you did a heck of a lot of shows.
Well, we did. We did mostly promotional shows, that is, not paid shows, during that summer, I remember, going to a lot of record hops. It was sort of in the old days, you know, it was right after payola. Well, actually, no money exchanged hands after payola, obviously. But what they did do, in every major market, it seems like there is one big station you have to have, or you had to have back then. And so what you would do is you would go to that market, and the disc jockey would say, well, I have a record hop tonight at the something fire hall. And if you come by and lip sync your record at my record hop, then I'll put your song on the playlist. And kind of that's what you had to do, you know, to get your record played when you were new. Obviously, the Supremes or something like that, you didn't have to do that anymore, but I guess that's sort of paying your dues. And so most of the traveling that we did really was to major markets to get the disc jockeys to play our record.
So after Birthday Party, you went back into the studio and recorded some more.
Yeah, this time we went to New York. Since we had a hit, we went to Mirror Sound. And that was sort of the premier studio of the time in New York City. And we did 442 Glenwood Avenue, and we had some of the finest musicians in the country on that song. I don't know if you remember Leon Huff of Gamble and Huff.
I know the name for sure.
Yeah, they did the Philadelphia Sound.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Leon Huff was our rehearsal pianist in Philadelphia, and he was about our age. And, of course, he became enormously successful later, but he played on our session. He was a young kid. I think he was 16, something like that. Used to stand up when he played. And Vinnie Bell, famous guitar player that everybody knows. We really had Trade Martin. We had some great musicians. People came in to watch the session, and it went all night, I remember. Yeah, one song all night. It wasn't so much that they wanted to improve the way we were singing it. Back in those days, they were trying different things, you know, different arrangements. They did the arrangement more on the spot, you know, in the studio than having it all planned out before we went in. But it turned out very well and was quite successful.
And you had that flip with something called Cold, Cold Winters.
Yeah, that was sort of devastating to that record, and the reason I say that is that we had two records on the top 100 at the same time, 442 and Cold Cold Winter. We got split play, and back in those days, they did not add those two together, the sales of both sides of your record together, to determine how high it would go. Now, they changed that in the 70s, but if they had done that, we would have had a top five record. That's how many records 442 backed with Cold Cold Winter Soul, if you added those two together.
And that's another record that hit number one on places like WCAO in Baltimore and WJDY in Maryland and so on and so forth. So it had substantial play, certainly for 442, and as you say, both songs actually charted at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So again, you're probably out doing the promotion thing with your second hit record.
Well, now this time we're actually getting paid.
Small difference there.
Yeah. And now we got to tour with some other groups, and we did a lot of shows now after 442. I guess we kind of paid our dues, and it was fun. It was exciting.
Did you have the same lineup of people, you, Debbie, and Midge, on that song?
Yes, we did.
The third release was a song that the Crows made popular called G.
Right. And actually, this is a point at which Midge left. Now, Midge was our lead singer on Birthday Party in 442. I had graduated from high school. Midge and I actually were 2 years older than Debbie. And so Debbie was still in high school, and Midge and I had graduated. And actually, I went to college. I only had two choices of a college to go to or to start at because we were still under contract with Mercury. So there were two that were within driving distance of home that I could go and live at the college and still have practices and all. So I went to Western Maryland College in Westminster. At the time, Midge decided to leave the group, and Bonnie came in. Now, Bonnie didn't really replace Midge because Debbie now became the lead singer. And Bonnie took over Debbie's part as singing high. And so at that point now, we made the album, A Party with the Pixies 3, and we also recorded during that same session G, which was our next release, right, the remake of The Crows.
That one also made the charts, so you continued in your touring, and or at least doing the shows, I should say.
Well, now we're hitting a period at which I think in pop music history, is unique in that while we were making this album and recording G, because G's not on the album, we're staying at the Plaza in New York. I will never forget this. And looked out the windows of this incredible hotel, you can imagine, coming from a small town. We were just in awe. And we're seeing mobs and mobs of girls down on the street, like picketing or something. We weren't sure what was going on. Well, we asked some people at the hotel, what are all these girls here for? And it turns out the Beatles were also staying at the Plaza, and they were going to appear on the Ed Sullivan Show the next night. And what happened, of course, is history, musical history.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think ever in pop music history has music changed overnight, but it did after that Ed Sullivan Show. And what happened with G and I think every other record that we put out after that was that nobody could get airtime except for the British invasion groups. You could not get your record played, and of course, I mean, unless you were a really established group at that time. And so that really hurt, like, everyone else in the business or all the smaller groups in the business. That kind of was the demise of the girl group era, even.
Mm-hmm.
The only one that I think really survived after that period was the Supremes.
Well, you had three other 45s that you released after G. Tell me a little bit about Orphan Boy.
Well, Orphan Boy was actually, I think it was sort of a Phil Spector clone. We're in this period now where we had released a couple of records, and we can't get airplay, and we're just reinventing, or I should say the producers, Madarin White, were kind of reinventing ourselves. If you look at the last things that we released, I don't know if you've ever heard them before, Love Me, Make Me Your Baby, Your Way. We're just trying kind of new sounds, you know, to try to find out what works and what we can get to sell. So our sound becomes sort of different as we move along, as we're kind of reinventing ourselves, trying to fit this new genre of music that nobody really gets yet.
You mentioned your producers, John Madera, David White. How important were they to your whole career?
Oh, they were very, very important. You know, I think because we were very young, we really didn't have much creative input in what we recorded and how we recorded. In fact, when they picked us up, we were pretty much, I would say, a three-part harmony group rather than a lead and background group. We had a sound, it's really interesting. I just have to tell you, one day in the early 80s, I was driving the car, I had the radio on, and nearly wrecked the car. This group came on that I said, oh my gosh, that's us, that's our sound, and that's the sound we used to sing before we signed with Mercury. And you know who it was? Wilson Phillips.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. We sounded unbelievably like Wilson Phillips. And their sound is lots and lots of girl harmony, not so much lead and background. I mean, they do occasional little leads and stuff like that. I don't know. I guess that wasn't popular at the time, and even though, as I said, we sang Moon River in solid three-part harmony with, you know, a little lead fillers here and there. Madeira and White kind of went with what was selling at the time, and if you looked at the Chiffons and the Cookies and the Crystals and all the girl groups that were selling at the time, it was all lead background sound that was not three-part harmony. They definitely had an influence. It would be interesting to know what would have happened if we had been older and, you know, more confident in our own abilities to speak out, you know, at sessions and rehearsals and that kind of thing, and maybe put that solid three-part harmony back in. If that maybe wasn't the new sound that they were trying to find and didn't find it.
So you may have already answered this question, but what really did then cause the Pixies 3 to break up?
What happened was actually Mercury dropped our contract after four songs that didn't chart. And at that point, Mercury kind of dropped our contract. So part of it was the fact that, you know, we didn't have a contract anymore. Right after that, we went to Cameo Parkway. They came to us. I can't remember exactly how it happened. And they had a song, a terrific song, and I'll tell you what it is in a minute. Anyway, so we worked it up, and it sounded wonderful. And the deal with Cameo Parkway was, let's go into the studio, let's do a sort of small session, not full orchestra and all that. Just go in for an hour or so, put this down sort of as a demo, and see how this song sounds with the Pixies 3 doing it. And everyone loved it. So they put the contracts together. We're supposed to come back, I believe this was on a Saturday, because, now remember, two of them, Bonnie was Debbie's age, were still in high school at this point. And so everything we did had to be done on the weekend. So we were going to come back the next weekend and do the full session. Everybody loved it. Well, in the interim, I believe it was on like a Tuesday, when we had the contracts in our hands, Barbara Lewis came out with the song, Make Me Your Baby. And so she beat us to it. So we almost got back in. Of course, that became a huge hit.
Did any of the Pixies 3 individually go on and make some more records?
Yes. After Make Me Your Baby, we kind of went our separate ways, I should say. You know, and I transferred it. I was in college, and I decided, well, I guess it's time to move on to a new era in my life. And I think that everybody felt that way. And so Debbie, she had just graduated from high school, Debbie and Bonnie both. And Debbie went to New York and was picked up by the Angels, who had just lost. She replaced Peggy Santiglia, who had just gone to, I believe, the New Christy Minstrels. And so she recorded with the Angels on RCA. They didn't have a hit, though, after that. She toured with them for a while. She did do something on her own. She recorded a song on Boom, I think it was. And then, actually, she never got out of the business. She was in various bands throughout the 70s and 80s. In fact, dropped the bands only when we reunited in the early 90s.
That sounds like a good time to fast forward to now. Tell me a little bit about what you guys are doing now.
Well, we are just having one heck of a good time. since we reunited, we don't do too many shows. It varies, maybe a dozen a year or a little less. The problem is that we live in two different states. For quite some time, we lived in three different states. It's hard to practice, hard to get together, you know. So maybe once a month commitment is about all we really want to have right now, either for rehearsals or for shows. So we're doing all these shows. I guess with the graying of America, I was just stunned to find out that there are people who, and also the internet has had a huge amount to do with the resurgence of interest, I think, in our group. One of the things that I just love, and I know I'm rambling a bit here, is I love the internet because I am now buying some of our stuff on eBay. Stuff that I have never even seen and didn't know existed. By that I mean, I didn't know our records were released in Europe. And I have one with a French cover, one with a Spanish cover. I have quite a few of our records from Japan with Japanese writing on it. Didn't know that we were released in Japan. And I've just met so many wonderful people who, over the internet, who come to our website, email us, that kind of thing, who have all kinds of interesting stories to tell.
Why don't you give us your internet site address?
Okay. It's www.thepixies3.com, and you can use either the word or the number 3.
And you have some new releases on CD as well, don't you?
Yes. Actually, we have put out 6 CDs. Since 91.
The latest CDs that you have out right now that are still available, or are which ones?
Well, some are sold out. I have a few left of a CD that we did with Crystal Ball Records called Our History from the Beginning. That will soon be sold out. I think I have 20 of those left. And that has everything that we did in the 60s, including some unreleased demos and even a couple of old practice tapes. It's definitely a collector's item. You know, the quality is kind of mixed because of the sources of some of the things. But it's been a very popular CD, and that's, like I said, we're at the very end of that. We also put out in 2001 a CD called Tribute to the Girl Groups, where we did all of our favorite girl group numbers, and I still have that. In 2003, we released our 40th anniversary CD, and that's probably one of the most popular sellers on our website. Everybody picked songs that they wanted to do, and every song had a story. One interesting story is 1, 2, 3. In the 60s, when we were rehearsing at the Schubert Theater, which was where the Mercury offices were, Len Barry, who was the lead singer of the Dovells, came in one day and said, "Pixies, I wrote a song for you." And he sang it. And we said, "Len, you know, those words, they're dumb. 1, 2, 3, it's so easy, like taking candy from a baby. I mean, we like the music, but, well, what can I say? We were kids, you know, we were dumb." So we turned that song down. And actually, he took it somewhere else, too. I can't remember. He couldn't get anybody else to record it, so he recorded it himself. Well, that story is on 40th anniversary CD, that song and that story. But one thing I have to tell you is that one of the most fun things is running into these same people 40 years later. And we did a show in Ocean City, Maryland, quite a few years ago. I can't remember who the headliner was, but the headliner got sick or something, couldn't come, and they flew in Len Barry as the replacement at the last minute. And we had not seen him now in 40 years since we turned down 1, 2, 3. And we opened, and he got up on the stage. We didn't have a time to talk to him, obviously, because he came in, and we were already there when I think we might even been on stage. He caught the last half of our show. And the first thing he did was he got up and he said to the audience, "Aren't those Pixies great?" He said, "Let me tell you a story." So he told them that story. But the punchline was, he said, "Mr. Holland's Opus has just been released, or has been re-released, I guess." And he said, "I just want you to know, Pixies, that I got a 6-figure check from Mr. Holland's Opus for 1, 2, 3. So Pixies, na, 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 na." Well, anyway, getting back to the 40th anniversary, we put Pop, Pop, Popeye on there. And you know the story behind that. That's how we got our recording contract.
Right.
And just things that had special meaning to it. And it's kind of good CD. Everybody seems to like it. And then the most recent CD is called Dance the Night Away, Party with the Pixies 3, and it's all dance-type songs, party songs. But the fun thing about this was that after 44 years, we reunited with John Madera, our old producer. In fact, I was doing a radio interview with someone, and he said, "Well, would you like to meet John Madera or talk to him again?" He said, "I just interviewed him a couple weeks ago." And I said, "Well, I'd love to." And what he did was he got us together on the air for the reunion. And one thing led to another. The next thing I know, I said, "John, how about singing on our next CD?" He was a singer. A lot of people don't know that. quite a few groups. He's very well known, he and David White, as producers, because they have sold over 200 million records worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all as a producer. So anyway, he sang What I Say. I'd just seen the movie Ray, and I said, let's do that. So he sang lead on What I Say, and we kind of clown around on it. And we backed him up on it. And actually, we were never in the studio together, because he's on the West Coast. We did this all through the Internet. I made a track. I sent it to him. I said, do whatever you want to with it. And he put his voice down, then sent me a WAV file in an MP3 format of his voice. And then I put that together with the track that I made, and then got the girls in, and we did the background. I mean, it's kind of interesting how it all worked out. And he loved it. Here I have now one of the world's best producers and ask him to lend his ear to Dance the Night Away. And he did. And so by email and that sort of thing, he did wonderful critiques of the recording, add a little reverb here, you know, delay this just slightly, that kind of thing. Just wonderful free advice.
Hmm.
So not only did he sing on that CD, he wrote the liner notes for our newest CD, and he also lent an ear to the mixing process, and I'm really, really delighted to have caught up with him again and have learned so much.
Well, Kay, is there anything that I may have missed that you want to share with everybody?
I guess the only thing I can think of right offhand, you've done a wonderful job of asking good questions, but I think the biggest surprise to me is that I would never have guessed I would be almost 60 years old up on the stage shaking my butt at this point in my life. I mean, I did not sing outside the shower for 27 years.
Mm.
Neither did Bonnie and Midge, actually. And it's just funny, you know, one thing led to another, this reuniting. And it's just been so amazing to find how many people remember the music and still like it. I mean, there are discussion groups for girl groups all over the Internet and lots of mail coming into our website. And I would never have predicted this. And it's just so nice to personally get to know people, you know, that you would never have had that opportunity if it weren't for this wonderful age of the Internet in which we live. To meet you, for example.
It's quite a deal. It's everything is so instant, and I think you pretty much demonstrated that with the making of that track that you were talking about with Tony Madera. You can get things done so quickly and have such instant response, I think. Well, Kay, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk to me and the listeners here in California. I sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure. And, I mean, who doesn't like reminiscing? I guess that's part of getting older.